exploit vulnerabilities against civilians, unquote. If Directive 62 had given me anything, it was a further invitation to get funding for counterterrorism and security programs. I set to work. By January, the president was set to ask the Congress for $10 billion for counterterrorism, security, weapons of mass destruction preparedness, and infrastructure protection. Before the overall federal budget went to Congress, however, the White House decided to have a week-long series of theme days. The White House communications staff called and informed us that we would have the third day for all that counterterrorism stuff. That meant we had about 36 hours to find a venue, get an audience, move in what the communications people called show-and-tells, and draft a speech. We called the National Academy of Sciences, which was four blocks from the White House, had an auditorium, and could easily assemble scientists to fill it. The theme would be using science and technology to increase our security. When our theme day dawned, I went to the Oval Office to attempt to do a pre-brief. For every public event on the president's schedule, there was a preceding 10-minute slot called a pre-brief, in which a member of the staff would explain to the president what the event was about and what he should do at it. Although it was abundantly clear that Clinton did not need, and in any event would not accept, pre-briefs, the schedule continued to carry them. One of two things happened during the assigned time slots. Either you were left sitting outside the Oval Office waiting, or you were invited in, and the president would discuss with you something other than the upcoming event. On our theme day, it was the latter. I feared he would discuss the impeachment, which was dominating the media and Washington chatter. Instead, the president chose to discuss the problems facing his cousin, a woman who administered public housing in Arkansas. We continued to discuss that topic as we walked to the limousine and drove through Foggy Bottom with sirens wailing. I sat next to him with a notebook filled with PowerPoint slides and backup material to answer any conceivable question about the $10 billion budget proposal. As the motorcade drove into the basement garage of the Academy, the president acknowledged my apparent concern that we talk about the topic at hand. "I read the speech, you know," he said, to calm any concern I might have that he thought this was healthcare theme day. "The way I see this whole problem, it's like arrows and shields." "Huh?" I asked, as we sat in the car and Secret Service agents stood waiting to open the doors. "Yeah, you know, like some guy invents the bow and arrow, and he's ahead for a while, till some guy invents the shield that catches all the arrows. Guy puts a wall around the town, and the enemy invents the catapult to go over the wall. Offense, defense. Action, reaction. Now we got new offensive weapons facing us, and we need new defensive ones. Am I right?" I acknowledged that that was one way to look at the problem. Sitting in the front row of the auditorium, I noticed that Clinton seemed to be rewriting the speech during the long introductory remarks. When he spoke, however, he used the text we had given him, and I followed along with my copy. Then my text ended, and the president did not. He stepped out from behind the podium and leaned on it and smiled down at me. My stomach dropped, because we had seen him do this before and knew what it meant. He was about to wing it, to ad-lib in a way that would either get us all in trouble, or be the best part of the speech, or both. What we are seeing here, as any military person in the audience can tell you, goes back to the dawn of time. An offensive weapon is developed, and it takes time to develop the defense. He talked of bows, arrows, castles, moats. Then he noted how things were different, because of the speed with which change is occurring. And technology was evolving. New offensive technologies were being developed, and defenses were not yet available. The president appealed to the audience to use the funds he sought to to get our best scientific minds to close the gap between the introduction of new weapons of terror and the creation of new defenses. The room erupted in applause. Clinton plunged into the audience and shook hands. When he got to me, he grabbed me and whispered in my ear, "You liked that ending, didn't you?" He had identified a new problem and was ramming through a major initiative to deal with it, even at a time of tight federal budgets. After the speech, Attorney General Reno, Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala, and I briefed the White House press corps on all of the initiatives. I knew we had made the conceptual breakthrough when Shalala began by saying, "HHS is now a key part in the fight against terrorism." Shalala would later join me and Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen on one of a five-part series of shows on Nightline entitled Bio War, focusing on the need for homeland protection against terrorists with weapons of mass destruction. Explaining to the press about terrorism was necessary to achieve Clinton's goal of preparing, but not frightening, the public. As part of a campaign of press briefings and speeches, I agreed to bring Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes to a secret location where we had stored tons of specialized medicines and equipment for dealing with a chemical or biological attack in the mid-Atlantic region. Stahl and I also discussed Osama bin Laden on that 60 Minutes segment. I acknowledged that Al-Qaeda sought weapons of mass destruction. For years, we had been receiving raw intelligence reports and finished CIA analyses saying that Al-Qaeda was seeking chemical or nuclear weapons. When we asked for further details, however, there were none. Frustrated, in early 2001, I called Charlie Allen, who had become the Assistant Director of Central Intelligence, for collection, a kind of overall coordinator of what all U.S. intelligence agencies were doing to get information. We agreed to assemble everyone from every intelligence agency who had any responsibility for collecting or analyzing information about Al-Qaeda and weapons of mass destruction. We met in a secret location in Northern Virginia. Charlie Allen and I split the group into two teams. The first team was told to assume the role of Al-Qaeda and to develop plans for acquiring weapons of mass destruction without the Americans knowing it. They had the rest of the day to develop the plan and report back. The second team was told they were in charge of American intelligence. They were told to assume that Al-Qaeda did actually have chemical and nuclear activities underway and had been successful in hiding them. The U.S. team could use any method or capability to find the activities, but they needed to do so quickly because, in the exercise, we knew that Al-Qaeda planned to use the weapons soon. The exercise taught us three lessons. First, there had not been a coordinated U.S. intelligence effort to think creatively about how to find any Al-Qaeda weapons of mass destruction. Second, it was easier to hide such a program than to discover it. And finally, it's impossible to prove a negative. That is, we could not prove Al-Qaeda had no weapons of mass destruction. Still, the U.S. analysts playing Al-Qaeda in our exercise had identified one area as a good place to hide. As a result, it was photographed repeatedly and its cave entrances mapped. The region was a valley in Afghanistan called Tora Bora. Chapter 8. Delenda Est. Our embassies in Tanzania and Kenya in East Africa were struck almost simultaneously on August 7, 1998. Our embassy in Tanzania was badly damaged. In Kenya, there was carnage. 257 were dead and 5,000 wounded. Among the fatalities were 12 Americans. Al-Qaeda had now followed up a fatwa or religious ruling earlier in 1998, declaring war on the United States with an actual act of war. The Counterterrorism Security Group met by secure video conference at 5 in the morning. "Let's begin. We're going to have to triage this, sequence it," I started the meeting, and covered how we would coordinate search and rescue, secure the two embassy sites with U.S. Marines, investigate the bombings using the FBI, send in a team to coordinate the various efforts, arrange to transport all the people and equipment, and think about stopping similar planned attacks. Finally, I addressed attribution and response. "CIA, let's meet in my office at 7:30 to go over the evidence. The senior officer from each CSG agency is invited. I expect we all know what the evidence will show. We will need to give the president options." That morning, the smaller, in-person meeting revealed initial evidence that Al-Qaeda had launched the attacks. Because we were all pretty certain where this was going, I asked the CIA and the Joint Chiefs of Staff to create a joint team to develop response options against Al-Qaeda. That day and the next several were consumed with meetings with the president and the principals, coordination of the flow to Africa, and preparation to receive the bodies of our dead. A week passed in a flash. 7 days after the attack, the principals met again with the president. Just before going to the meeting, I read a CIA report from a source in Afghanistan that bin Laden and his top staff were planning a meeting on August 20th to review the results of their attacks and to plan the next wave. This report meant we had the opportunity not merely to stage a retaliatory bombing, but also a chance to get bin Laden and his top deputies, if the president would agree to a strike now, during the white-hot Monica scandal press coverage. In the meeting, the CIA and FBI provided detailed evidence that the operation had been Al-Qaeda's. The president asked National Security Advisor Sandy Berger to coordinate all of the moving parts necessary for a military response, tentatively planned for August 20th, 6 days later. Military assets had to be moved into place. Pakistan would have to be dealt with in some way. Clinton also asked Berger to pull together an overall plan to deal with Al-Qaeda. "Listen, retaliating for these attacks is all well and good, but we got to get rid of these guys once and for all," Clinton said, looking seriously over his half glasses. "You understand what I'm telling you?" Any U.S. military strike on Afghanistan would have to cross Pakistani airspace. If they were not told in advance, they might shoot down our aircraft or cruise missiles. If they were told in advance, some of us believed that the Pakistani intelligence service would alert the Taliban and possibly Al-Qaeda. The State Department Deputy Secretary, Strobe Talbot, also feared that the Pakistanis would see the U.S. attack coming and assume it was an Indian air raid. Talbot thought that Pakistan would not hesitate to launch an attack on India, even before confirming what was going on, and that could trigger a nuclear war between the two South Asian rivals, each of which now had nuclear bombs. All of this was taking place against the backdrop of the continuing Monica scandal. Like most of his advisors, I was beyond mad that the president had not shown enough discretion or self-control. Although, from what I knew of presidential history, marital fidelity had also been a problem for several of his illustrious predecessors. I was angrier, almost incredulous, that the bitterness of Clinton's enemies knew no bounds, that they intended to hurt not just Clinton, but the country, by turning the president's personal problem into a global public circus for their own political ends. Now, I feared that the timing of the president's interrogation about the scandal, August 17th, would get in the way of our hitting an Al-Qaeda meeting. It did not. Clinton made clear that we were to give him our best national security advice, without regard to his personal problems. Do you all recommend that we strike on the 20th? Fine. Do not give me political advice or personal advice about the timing. That's my problem. Let me worry about that. If we thought that was the best time to hit the Afghan camps, he would order it, and take the heat, for the wag-the-dog criticism that we all knew would happen, for the media and congressional reaction that would say he was using a military strike to divert attention from his deposition in the investigation. Wag the Dog was a movie that had been released that year, in which fictional presidential advisers create an artificial crisis with Albania to attack it and divert attention from domestic problems. Ironically, Clinton was blamed for a Wag the Dog strategy in 1998, dealing with the real threat from Al-Qaeda. But no one labeled Bush's 2003 war on Iraq as a Wag the Dog move, even though the crisis was manufactured, and Bush's political advisor Karl Rove was telling Republicans to, quote, run on the war, unquote. Clinton testified on the 17th and flew to Martha's Vineyard. He had one full day of vacation when Don Kerrick, deputy national security advisor, arrived with the final plans for the attack on Al-Qaeda. The CIA and Joint Chiefs had nominated not just buildings at the Al-Qaeda camp scheduled to host the meetings, but also other Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan and facilities in Sudan that bin Laden had invested in. They recommended that the attack be conducted only with cruise missiles, not commandos or piloted aircraft, either of which could result in U.S. casualties or prisoners. Joint Chiefs Vice Chairman Joe Ralston had agreed to fly to Pakistan, stopping at the airport allegedly for refueling en route from somewhere else. He had called the head of the Pakistani military and invited him to a one-on-one dinner on the 20th at the airport to discuss the tensions between the United States and Pakistan. The Pakistani general, a friend of Ralston's, had accepted. The cruise missiles would hit Pakistan's airspace and be detected while the dinner was going on. Ralston would explain that they were our missiles and should not be shot at. The plan called for Ralston to get on his plane and leave before dessert was served. The night of the attack, I assumed the targets were locked in. The president, however, was still wondering about one commercial facility in Sudan owned by bin Laden. At the last possible minute, he pulled that target off the list because it had no military or offensive value to Al-Qaeda. He left on the list a chemical plant in Shifa that the CIA had linked to Al-Qaeda and to a unique chemical weapons compound that had been used as a prime ingredient in Iraqi nerve gas. In the northern Arabian Sea, U.S. destroyers were lining up, their missiles spinning in their launch tubes. Then, the first of 75 missiles were launched. Some circled until others were launched, and then they all flew together toward the Pakistani coast at 400 miles an hour. Almost 2 hours later, they would hit the Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan. Other tomahawks were being fired from the Red Sea toward Shifa in Sudan. Reports differ concerning how close the cruise missile attack came to hitting the Al-Qaeda leadership. Whatever the truth is, bin Laden was not killed in the raid. The American public's reaction to the U.S. retaliation over the next several days was about as adverse as we could have imagined. According to the media and many in Congress, Clinton had launched a military strike to divert attention from the Monica scandal. CIA Chief Tennant was probably making up the story of an Al-Qaeda meeting because bin Laden was still alive. The Sudanese were to be believed that they had never made chemical weapons precursors at Shifa, or if they had, it was certainly just to kill weeds. The Defense Department had wasted valuable cruise missiles attacking huts and tents. And Clinton stopped the military from putting boots on the ground in Afghanistan and had insisted on the ineffectual cruise missiles. Real men use commandos. Our response to two deadly terrorist attacks was an attempt to wipe out al-Qaeda's leadership. Yet it quickly became grist for the right-wing talk radio mill and part of the Get Clinton campaign. That reaction made it more difficult to get approval for follow-up attacks on al-Qaeda, such as my later attempts to persuade the principals to forget about finding bin Laden and just bomb the training camps. What was particularly frustrating was that Clinton had pulled Joint Chiefs Chairman Hugh Shelton and me aside after the cabinet room meeting, saying to the former Special Forces commander, "Hugh, what I think would scare the shit out of these al-Qaeda guys more than any cruise missile would be the sight of U.S. commandos, ninja guys in black suits, jumping out of helicopters into their camps, spraying machine guns. Even if we don't get the big guys, it'll have a good effect." Shelton looked pained. He explained that the camps were a long way away from anywhere we could launch a helicopter raid. Nonetheless, America's top military officer agreed to, quote, "look into it," unquote. On the same day that we sent cruise missiles into Afghanistan, President Clinton signed Executive Order 13099, imposing sanctions against Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Some months later, these sanctions would be extended to the Taliban. With these orders, the focus of U.S. strategy to combat al-Qaeda's financial network moved from a narrow approach focused primarily on law enforcement to a wider approach that aimed to bring into the fight all the varied tools and resources of the U.S. government. I asked Will Wexler of my staff to lead a new subgroup on terrorist financing. Will began by meeting with Rick Newcomb, the quietly effective head of the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control, and the architect of the effort against the Colombian Cali drug cartel. Together, they asked all those in the intelligence community, law enforcement agencies, and the State Department who were supposed to know about terrorist financing what they knew about al-Qaeda's financing. Will came into my office looking worried after his first round of meetings. "This is insane," he said. "FBI thinks we should just leave this to them, but they can't tell me anything I can't read in the newspaper. CIA gave us a data dump of everything they've ever come across on the subject, and they think that answers the question. There are no formal assessments at all, no understanding of the whole picture of where the money is coming from. The general impression I get out there is that this is all a big waste of time because they keep saying it doesn't take much money to blow something up, and Osama's got all the money he needs from Daddy." "You need to pull together a small group of people who will get the answers," I told Will. "The CIA guys are crazy if they think bin Laden is doing this global network on the cheap." Wexler came back some weeks later with what they had come to call the new theory of the case. Although any one terrorist act might cost only a little, it took a lot of money to run everything that al-Qaeda was up to. And while bin Laden's own personal fortune was undoubtedly useful in setting up al-Qaeda, the organization's financial network was far beyond one man's wallet. Instead, we were looking at a vast global fundraising machine. This machine involved both legitimate businesses and criminal enterprises. We then learned about the Hawala system, an ancient underground system that offers money transfers without money movement, and virtually no paper trail. The CIA knew little about the system, but set about learning. The FBI knew even less, and set about doing nothing. Once they had developed their theory of the case, Will, Rick, and their small team then set about strategizing what to do about it. One thing was clear: a lot of the money being raised was coming from people in Saudi Arabia. We decided that we needed to have a serious talk with the Saudis as well as with a few of the financial centers in the region. In the end, however, despite Saudi promises to provide additional information and support, little was forthcoming. And although the Clinton administration had sought tougher money laundering provisions, only after 9/11 did the Congress muster the political will to strengthen U.S. laws to fight terrorist financing and money laundering. After Secretary Robert Rubin stepped down in 1999, it was easier to get cooperation from Treasury. Rubin had opposed our use of the International Economic Emergency Powers Act to go after terrorist financing fronts in the United States. His attitude toward strengthening international money laundering rules had been less than enthusiastic. The new Treasury Secretary, Larry Summers, was surprisingly a breath of fresh air. He asked Will Wexler to join him for the last year of the Clinton administration in developing a multilateral approach to name and shame foreign money laundering havens that were providing no-questions-asked financial services for al-Qaeda and other terrorists and criminal groups. This initiative made countries pay a price in the financial markets for their lack of cooperation and thus successfully forced over a dozen countries to rewrite their laws. Liechtenstein and the Bahamas later used those new laws after 9/11 to help us track down and freeze a key part of al-Qaeda's financial network. When the Bush administration came into office, I wanted to raise the profile of our efforts to combat terrorist financing, but found little interest. The new president's economic advisor, Larry Lindsey, had long argued for weakening U.S. anti-money laundering laws in a way that would undercut international standards. The new Secretary of the Treasury, Paul O'Neill, was lukewarm at best toward the multilateral efforts to name and shame foreign money laundering havens, and allowed the process to shut down before the status of Saudi Arabian cooperation was ever assessed. In general, the Bush appointees distrusted anything invented by the Clinton administration and anything of a multilateral nature. So the international terrorist financing effort had two strikes against it. The new Bush focus in early 2001 was on confronting China, withdrawing from various multilateral obligations, and spending much more money on an anti-missile defense system, not on looking into al-Qaeda's financial network. Although Clinton had approved the retaliatory bombing and the sanctions after the attacks on the African embassies, he had also asked Sandy Berger for an overall plan to deal with al-Qaeda. My team set out to develop what we had taken to calling a Paul Mill plan, a politico-military plan. Every military operation has a code word or phrase. To express the intent of the Paul Mill plan for al-Qaeda, I borrowed a phrase from Cato the Elder, Roman senator and famous orator, who, in 201 BC, had encouraged war by ending every speech with the line, "Carthage must be destroyed," or, as Cato would have said it, "Carthago delenda est." When the Paul Mill plan was handed out, it was labeled Top Secret Delenda. The Undersecretaries of State and Defense, Tom Pickering and Walt Slocum, looked up from their copies knowingly. "You're right," Pickering said. "Al-Qaeda must be destroyed." Destroying al-Qaeda would require a multifaceted, detailed plan. Intelligence agencies would need to identify and break up al-Qaeda's cells, find its money, train and arm its enemies, and eliminate its leaders. Law enforcement agencies had similar responsibilities, including finding sleeper cells in the United States. The State Department would persuade other governments to assist us, would provide international approval of our actions, and would fund nations that needed help to join in our efforts. The Defense and State Departments would reduce the number of low-hanging fruit targets by hardening facilities. Treasury would seize al-Qaeda funds here and work with the international banking system to freeze them elsewhere. Resources were needed and were identified. Additional legal authorities were required, and plans to obtain them were detailed. Military plans were requested for additional bombing and possible commando operations. During their review of the Paul Mill plan, the principals had agreed that we should stop referring publicly to Osama bin Laden, who had survived the August 20 missile strike, and focus attention on the network, Al-Qaeda. Unfortunately, few of the principals then did so in their public comments. Like the media, the principals were fixated on one man, the leader of this group that had declared war on us for no good reason. Given the reluctance of the military to plan seriously for commando operations in Afghanistan, and the fecklessness to date of the CIA's Afghan friends, the best option to get bin Laden seemed to be to hit a building in which he was staying. For that purpose, the Defense Department was asked to keep cruise missile platforms off the Pakistani coast. The targets were places bin Laden was thought to have been before. Now, all we needed was word that he was at one of those places again and would likely stay there for a few hours. That proved hard to get. The CIA's assets in Afghanistan could usually tell us where bin Laden had been a few days earlier. In three meetings during 1998 and 1999, the Counterterrorism Security Group requested emergency meetings of the principals to recommend to the president a cruise missile strike on the facility in which bin Laden was believed to be at the time. We had to act quickly. By the time the information reached us, it was already getting old. On each of the three occasions when we thought we had an opportunity, however, there was reason not to fire the missiles. Twice, George Tenet admitted to the principals that the information came from a single source that was not always right. On the third occasion, Tenet and I carefully examined satellite photos of the CIA's proposed target and determined that it looked a lot more like a luxury mobile home camp of an Arab ally than a terrorist hideout. The planned attack was canceled. Tenet's later review of the three events, using other sources who were able to report later on, revealed that only on one of the occasions was bin Laden actually at the proposed target when we thought he was. On that occasion, the house bin Laden was in was located next to a hospital, which would have received collateral damage from the cruise missile attack. On these three occasions, and during the presentation of the Paul Mill plan, I tried to make the case to the principals that we should strike at all Al-Qaeda camps, whether or not bin Laden was in them. The response I received from all the other members of the principals usually went along the lines of, "So, we spend millions of dollars worth of cruise missiles and bombs blowing up a $150's worth of jungle gyms and mud huts again?" Several times I tried the line of argument that the camps, whatever it cost to build them, were churning out thousands of trained terrorists who were going home and setting up cells in countries all over the world. "We have to stop this conveyor belt, this production line. Blow them up every once in a while and recruits won't go there." This line of reasoning had some impact on the principals, but not enough. Nonetheless, the idea of bombing all of the Al-Qaeda infrastructure was never ruled out. Indeed, the Joint Chiefs were instructed to prepare plans to hit the facilities not only with cruise missiles, but with B-1, B-2, and B-52 strategic bombers. I waited for another opportunity to make the case. While there was little support for a large-scale bombing campaign, there continued to be interest in eliminating the Al-Qaeda leadership. For years, we had assumed that the executive order against U.S. agencies engaging in assassination was a firm ban against the use of lethal force in non-military situations. Al-Qaeda and bin Laden tested our own restraint. They seemed intent on continuing to kill innocent people, Americans and others. The U.S. military had been unable to come up with a way of attacking the Al-Qaeda leadership effectively. Gradually, the principals accepted the idea that we needed to examine our policy on targeted assassination. On the issue of the White House authorizing the CIA to kill bin Laden, much has been written. Several reporters have written that President Clinton approved multiple intelligence documents authorizing CIA to use lethal force against Osama bin Laden and his deputies. Yet bin Laden was not killed. I still, to this day, do not understand why it was impossible for the United States to find a competent group of Afghans, Americans, third country nationals, or some combination, who could locate bin Laden in Afghanistan and kill him. Some have claimed that the lethal authorizations were convoluted and the people in the field did not know what they could do. Every time such an objection was raised during those years, an additional authorization was drafted with the involvement of all the concerned agencies and approved by the president's signature. The principals and the president did not want a broad assassination policy and hit list, but the president's intent was very clear. Kill bin Laden. I believe that those in CIA who claim the authorizations were insufficient or unclear are throwing up that claim as an excuse to cover the fact that they were pathetically unable to accomplish the mission. Chapter 9, Millennium Alert. Early in December 1999, the head of CIA's Counterterrorism Center, Kofor Black, called me. "We have to go to battle stations." "Kofor, it's not Friday," I joked. It had become something of a tradition that either Black or FBI Assistant Director Dale Watson would call on Friday afternoons with late-breaking news that would cause us to spend the weekend in the office. We called the regular Friday afternoon counterterrorism security group meetings the Friday Follies. "No, Dick, this is the real deal," Black insisted. "Jordan infiltrated a cell, planning lots of bang-bang for New Year's. The Radisson Hotel, Christian tourist sites, lots of dead Americans. Deal is, Dick, I don't think this is it. You know bin Laden. He likes attacks in multiple locations. They're like cockroaches. You see one, but you know that means there's a whole nest of them." Kofor Black was a hard-charging, get-it-done kind of CIA officer who had proved himself in the back alleys of unsavory places. He was what the CIA needed a lot more of, but had little of. I had urged George Tenet to find such a guy to run the Counterterrorism Center, someone who shared Tenet's view and mine that we had to go on the offensive. Unfortunately, Black reported to Tenet through CIA's Deputy Director of Operations, Jim Pavitt, and Pavitt thought both Tenet and I were exaggerating the whole Al-Qaeda threat and would get the CIA in trouble. Now, however, Black had proof that Al-Qaeda was planning attacks around the Millennium rollover. In the months leading up to Kofor's call, much had been done to reduce our vulnerabilities at home and abroad. We had hundreds of foreign diplomatic facilities in over 180 nations. Many were so vulnerable that they invited attack. The institutional culture of the Department of State, however, resisted protecting the embassies. U.S. diplomats hated being housed in fortresses, walled off from the societies that they were supposed to be serving. If there were new funds, the Department of State had many things it would do with the money other than build more fortresses. I found this attitude dismaying. I knew that Madeleine Albright would understand the problem. After a principal's meeting in the West Wing, I had asked to speak one-on-one, and we walked together up West Executive Drive while her motorcade waited. "What do you think will happen if you lose another embassy? The Republicans in the Congress will go after you." I had her attention. She shot back. "First of all, I didn't lose those two embassies. I inherited them in the shape they were." Then, the Secretary of State, realizing that I was a friend who had tried to help her get the job, smiled coyly at me. "I know you, Dick. You have a plan. What is it you want me to approve?" "Share the burden. These embassies don't just house State Department people. They have staff from a dozen agencies in them. Let's get them on the hook, too. With Secretary Albright's approval, the White House took on the embassy security mission. I sent teams of diplomatic security, Secret Service, FBI, FEMA, and Defense Department experts to cities around the world to survey our embassies the way a terrorist would. What streets did we need to close to prevent a truck bomb from getting too close? Were there enough local police, and were they doing their job? Where did we need machine guns and fire zones? The teams came back with lists of immediate steps to harden scores of embassies. They also had embassies that could not be saved. Those embassies were closed, and the State Department sent out property buyers to find new locations. We were able, in the wake of the embassy attacks, to persuade Congress to provide another emergency supplemental appropriation. Yet, when it came time for the fiscal year 2000 budget, the State Department's submission to the White House did not include the funds to continue the embassy hardening program. In a matter of 4 months from the attacks in Africa, embassy protection had slipped back to a low budget priority. I called Josh Gottbaum, the number three person at the Office of Management and Budget, and the official designated to work with me to make sure the president's terrorism and homeland protection priorities were funded. I explained the problem. Josh got it. Well, seems to me that it's the president's embassies and it's the president's budget, not the State Department's. Let me see here. Yes, I think we'll just drop several hundred million from what they want and add several hundred million of what we know the president would want. Done. Meanwhile, the State Department had been hard at work trying to put pressure on the Taliban to close the terrorist camps in Afghanistan and hand over the terrorists. Unfortunately, we had little leverage with the Taliban. The three nations that did have leverage were Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. All three had appealed on our behalf to the Taliban to cooperate on bin Laden. We also spoke directly to the Taliban. The answers that came back from Kandahar were transparent rejections, but the Taliban assured us they were preventing bin Laden from engaging in any terrorism. In response, we had adopted a three-part strategy. First, I granted a media interview in which I stated that if there were any further al-Qaeda terrorism against the United States, we would hold the Taliban responsible and retaliate against them next time. Second, we asked the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates to terminate diplomatic relations with Afghanistan and terminate foreign aid. They did. Third, the president ordered all Taliban assets in the United States seized. In a rare show of solidarity, the United States and Russia co-sponsored the sanctions in the UN Security Council. There were two problems that had prevented progress with the Taliban. The first was that the Taliban rightly believed that if they evicted bin Laden, as Sudan had done, the U.S. would then have other objections that would block aid. America would want the Taliban to ensure women's rights and would insist on verifying an end to opium production. The second problem was that the Taliban leaders, including Mullah Omar, completely agreed with bin Laden and al-Qaeda's goals. While all of this was going on, of course, al-Qaeda was busy laying the groundwork for an attack against us. The millennium was approaching, and it was a temptingly symbolic occasion. From my position, at the time of Kofor's phone call, not yet knowing of al-Qaeda's plans, I had only limited options. I had tried to argue that the U.S. work harder to fight against the Taliban in its civil war in Afghanistan. The Northern Alliance still held sway over a third of the country, but it was only a matter of time before that alliance crumbled. I argued that we could provide the counterweight, sending arms and funds to Massoud's northern forces. Once again, the CIA's career management saw my proposal to aid the Northern Alliance as a risk to the CIA. For those who had spent 15, 20, or more years in the CIA, there was a clear pattern. Whoever was in the White House would get worked up over the cause du jour. He would be unable to get the rest of the government to produce results, so he would turn to the CIA. He would push the CIA to do risky, potentially controversial things. Later, after things went badly, the White House people would be gone, and the CIA would get the blame. In the final analysis, the CIA proclaimed the Northern Alliance was feckless and no match for the Taliban. And any money to help Massoud, apart from token aid that the CIA called trinkets, would have to be given to the agency over and above all funds already available to CIA. This reluctance to fund the Northern Alliance caused me to wonder exactly what the CIA was doing with all of the counterterrorism budget increases the White House had given them. In 2000 and in 2001, we asked the CIA to identify some funds, any money, earmarked for other activities that were less important than the fight against al-Qaeda, so that those funds could be transferred to the higher priority of countering bin Laden. The formal, official CIA response was that there were no such funds. This institutional response was in sharp contrast to George Tenet's personal fixation with al-Qaeda. It was also in sharp contrast to the attitude in the Counterterrorism Center at the CIA, which by 1997 was led by the hard-charging Kofor Black. Black wanted to destroy al-Qaeda as much as I did, if only the CIA Directorate of Operations would let him. When Black called that day in 1999, we quickly convened a counterterrorism security group meeting and sent out warnings to U.S. embassies, military bases, and to the 18,000 police agencies in the United States. The message? Be advised. Al-Qaeda terrorists may be planning attacks around the time of the millennium. Be on heightened alert for suspicious activity. And then we waited. The break came in an unlikely location. A pleasant boat ride from British Columbia to Washington State ended with a routine screening by U.S. customs officers. One passenger in line fidgeted, would not make eye contact. When the customs officer, Diana Dean, went to pull him out of line, he bolted and ran off the boat, leaving his car on the ferry. Dean gave chase and called for backup. A few minutes later, Ahmed Rassam was in custody. His car held explosives and a map of Los Angeles International Airport. If that were not enough to send us spinning, the CIA had learned further details about the al-Qaeda plot in Jordan. The head of the cell, who had helped assemble the bombs, had recently quit his job as a cab driver in Boston. The Jordanian crown prince, visiting the bomb factory, hidden in an upper-middle-class home, had been amazed at the size of the hall. They weren't planning terrorism. They were planning a revolution. The king immediately declared a state of emergency and flooded the streets with soldiers and armored vehicles. More than the usual suspects were swept up and interrogated. The investigation led to an al-Qaeda operative in Pakistan and to another American who lived not far from Los Angeles International Airport. National Security Advisor Sandy Berger convened the principals in crisis mode. We've stopped two sets of attacks planned for the millennium. You can bet your measly federal paycheck that there are more out there, and we have to stop them too. I spoke with the president, and he wants you all to know. Berger looked at Janet Reno, Louis Free, George Tenet, that this is it. Nothing more important. All assets. We stop this fucker. Following the first of these principals' meetings, we prepared, at Berger's request, a political-military plan for the Millennium Alert, alerting units, increasing security, rounding up suspects around the world. This time, the FBI did one of the things it is very good at. It threw bodies at the problem. Thousands of agents fanned out, pulling at strings. The strings from Rassam, the man on the ferry, led to a sleeper cell of Algerian Mujahideen in Montreal. For the next several days, as Christmas and then the millennium approached, Berger held daily principals' meetings that often sounded like the pre-watch briefings on Hill Street Blues. Tenet called his key counterparts around the world, wringing out the details, cajoling security services into preemptive raids on possible cells. In addition to coordinating the offensive, The counterterrorism security group prepared for the worst. Disaster recovery units were pre-positioned. No one in the counterterrorism business was going to have any holidays, especially New Year's Eve. In a vault, just off the floor of the Y2K Coordination Center, we waited for midnight in Riyadh, then in Paris. There were no major computer failures and no explosions. At midnight, I went to the roof to look down on the celebration at the Lincoln Memorial. Fireworks burst in the cold night sky. As the celebration ended and the president's motorcade began to return to the White House to continue the party, Sandy Berger called from the limousine. "So far, so good. Any signs of trouble?" "No, but Los Angeles celebrates in 3 hours." At 3 a.m., we went back to the rooftop and finally popped a bottle of champagne. After what became known as the Millennium Terrorist Alert of December 1999, the principals chartered the Counterterrorism Security Group to prepare a Millennium After Action Review. Each agency examined what it had learned, and the group collectively looked at our shortcomings. The list of shortcomings clustered around one fact: that there were probably Al-Qaeda sleeper cells in the United States. Officially, the FBI said they knew of only a handful of sympathizers who were under surveillance. There were no active cells, no indigenously based threat, according to the Bureau. John O'Neill and I believed otherwise, but O'Neill had transferred to the New York office. It was the most important FBI office in the country, and O'Neill had made it the operational arm of the FBI for going after Al-Qaeda overseas. Nonetheless, in the 56 field offices except New York, the emphasis was on drugs, organized crime, and other issues that generated arrests and prosecutions. In some cities, we had created joint terrorism task forces that brought together representatives from all the local and federal law enforcement agencies. In every instance, the special agents in charge and the directors of the joint terrorism task forces professed there was no Al-Qaeda presence in their region, but they had taken almost no steps to uncover any in the first place. "Is there an Al-Qaeda presence in the city?" I would ask. Often I would get the response, "What's Al-Qaeda? Is that Bin Laden guy? He hasn't been here." Roger Cressy or Paul Kurtz would follow up. "What do they say about jihad at the mosques here after the services? What do they pass out? What do they collect money for?" "Hell, we can't go to a mosque or even a church unless we have cause. Can't send a source in either," would always be the answer. They also noted that the Attorney General's guidelines made it impossible for them to do things without already knowing about a probable crime. They were prohibited from printing an organization's webpage unless they suspected a crime was in progress. In many cities, the agents did not even have internet access. The Attorney General's guidelines were initially adopted in the wake of the Watergate-era scandals of the early 1970s. During that period, it had been revealed that the FBI had kept files on people and groups for no other reason than J. Edgar